Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is September 28th, 2013. Another edition of Truth Frequency for you this Saturday. Joining us in the second and third hour, we're going to have Brooks Agnew back on the broadcast. We're going to talk about Comet Ison today because it's something that I didn't pay attention to at first. But as I start to see things unfolding, I'm starting to realize that there's more and more validity behind some type of event. Last night over Indiana, seen in about seven states, landing in Ohio, I believe. It's kind of hard to pinpoint exactly the location, but there were fireballs in the sky over Texas, and it's been happening for the last couple of days. So something's definitely pounding down onto the earth right now as Comet Ison approaches. Cherie wrote a great article about that. Do you want to go over that?
Yeah, sure. About 1,100 reports have been called into the American Meteor Society over the past 3 days, and that's quite a bit. I'm pulling it up right now. Large meteor explodes over eight states, EM interference and sonic booms reported. A very large fireball or series of them were seen this evening, that was last night, across several states and is apparently causing strange interference with cellular, internet, and even satellite communications throughout the Ohio Valley. Local news outlet Fox 19 reports the American Meteor Society quickly received almost 200 online reports of the event, with 131 coming from Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, and 46 more from Illinois, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia as of shortly after midnight Eastern Daylight Time. Now, if you look at the video, videos that I posted up on here, it's amazing. One of them is bright blue. And then the ones seen in Texas over the last week have been green, red, yellow, and all just kinds of colors. And so it's unusual, but not for this time of year. Apparently there are a lot of meteor showers this time of year, but not to this extent, not to the extent that 1,100 people call in saying, oh my gosh, it was like unlike anything I've ever seen. Radio show Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis, we were listening to it last night, received dozens of calls from frightened witnesses, one of whom also put the phone up to the satellite-connected TV service during the call, which was making a very odd and very persistent noise consistent with EM interference. Witnesses also turned to Twitter to express their shock and awe at the event. Watched fireball over north-central West Virginia. Brightest explosion and fastest movement I've ever seen or imagined. Fully expected a shockwave, but heard none. The American Meteor Society has not yet updated the site, well, they have now, but to reflect the latest reports. However, concerning the sightings on the 26th, that was a few days ago, they said AMS received 715 reports about this fireball seen over Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, Tennessee, and Wisconsin on September 26, 2013, around 10:59 p.m. This comes on the heels of fireballs being reported across the world over the past few days, with over 400 being reported on the 26th and a total of 715 by midnight on the 28th. This September has been a busy month for fireballs in the USA, the latest marking the 13th significant event so far this month. That means it's the 13th meteor just this past month, more than any month in the history of the online AMS fireball report. A significant event is defined as a fireball event reported by at least 25 or more witnesses. Other notable media-related events occurred on 9/21 in northern Alberta, Canada. 9/21 also all the way south to Texas. The meteor, which appeared as a green fireball, shot through the sky on Saturday night, September 21st, around 9 p.m. Central. Witnesses from all over Texas, including Abilene, Austin, the DFW Metroplex, Houston, and Waco, reported seeing the fireball. There's also a video of that. 9/23, also in Texas, but a different time of the day. 9/23 in West Virginia. Huge fireball, green and white. Seen from southern West Virginia, 4 to 6 seconds, brightness and size of a half moon, heading due east just prior to the moonrise over the mountains. So obviously there's something going on, especially if there's any kind of electromagnetic interference being caused by this.
Well, I can tell you firsthand in my experience over the last few days, I've noticed a lot of weird stuff going on with the electronics. The cell phone service has been pretty much nothing. I can go to certain areas that are right around the corner from here and no service at all. We were eating at a restaurant yesterday, no service in the restaurant, couldn't get on the internet. I haven't been able to get on the internet on my phone in probably a week And, you know, I sometimes I can get on it, sometimes I can't, but it's becoming more not than being able to get on it. So a lot of people are reporting strange electronic interference, and we've had problems with our network, KTFRN as well, with things just acting haywire, and who knows. But we do know that a while back, FEMA was preparing to purchase storable food and was making inquiries into how much they can get in a short amount of time. And we broke the story here first on Truth Frequency and put it up on truthfrequencyradio.com. We even took it a step further and actually spoke to somebody from FEMA. And he gave us a scenario which included the tri-state area being taken out, or a big part of it, and a lot of people displaced and having to get storable food for them. Well, since then, FEMA has actually placed those orders, 14 million orders to be shipped to FEMA Region 3, which is the Washington, D.C., Philadelphia area, and also 2 million units to be shipped to Austin, Texas, which is a bit strange in itself. But the orders have been placed, so a lot of people are saying, oh, this is fear-mongering, this is that. Well, the orders are already placed. So they're gearing up for something, and it's very likely that they're expecting something to happen. There's a lot of things to indicate October 1st is a date to look out for. Now, there's a lot of disinformation out there as well. I've heard people talking about 3 days of darkness starting September 27th and going up into the 1st. It's sunny as can be here. It's actually disturbingly sunny, because yesterday we had a nice gray, stormy atmosphere. Today it's a completely sunny day. October 1st also is the end of a UN peacekeeping training drill that is taking place right now, and the troops are being trained in English and also in using American weapon systems, and they're being trained in urban warfare.
Also, the feds have plans, apparently, for October 1st. I'm trying to pull it up right now. It does seem like the internet has been iffy the last several days. Don't look now, but what the government doesn't want us to know, and what the D.C. Navy Yard massacre may have been about, may be a result of mind control, something the perpetrator, Aaron Alexis, was trying to tell others about.
But it could be coming up in the coming weeks.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that if the government had foreknowledge of this, that they would make an end date. Okay, we have to have the food here by October 1st. We have to have the troops ready by October 1st, because October 1st it's going to go down.
Right.
They would give it a few weeks.
Not likely. Yeah.
Right.
It's more likely that it would be 4 to 6 weeks. I would say between three and six weeks before something were to happen. They would have to have everything in place, and that includes the storable food, like you said, shelter, decontamination kits, possibly. They're training for everybody to be ready with training for, you know, large weapons, right?
Well, everybody, including us, has been telling you that you have to get prepared. At this point, I don't even know if it's possible to get storable food from mypatriotsupply.com, but I would place an order at this particular time and see if you can get something before some kind of event happens, just in case, just to be on the safe side. We've got ours, and we feel a lot better as a result of it. But interesting enough, I was listening to Clyde Lewis last night, and he was running commercials, and it wasn't him, of course. It was his network. He's on Fox. Fox was running ads from FEMA, mm-hmm. and FEMA was telling you to get prepared and to go to their website about how to get prepared. So when FEMA's telling you to get prepared, and the alternative media is telling you to get prepared, and everybody's telling you to get prepared, well, that means that you're going to be on your own. So you really need to consider that.
I was always told that if FEMA's telling you to get prepared, it's already too late, that you've already passed a date where you can get yourself sufficiently prepared, that they won't tell you anything until it's too late, and you can just get whatever you can, which is about 5 to 10 days worth of stuff. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it does feel like something's...
Well, Walmart's even carrying 3-day preparedness meals mm-hmm. at their stores. So
right.
something's coming down, and it's those of us who can see who will be prepared and who will survive through it. Or then again, let's look at the flip side of the coin. Maybe it's a distraction from something bigger. We never know.
Well, if you don't have your stuff together by now, then he must have been living under a rock or something.
We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. That ice sun isn't really a ball of ice. That it's really a lot deeper than that, and it's going to create some really strange electromagnetic pulses directed at the sun, and the sun will start letting off solar flares and things like that. And all we need is for the grid to just get knocked out, and that's it. It's over. Game over. And there are birthing pains, and just like when the comet came and struck down, according to official science anyways, and struck the Earth and all the dinosaurs left, then something new came, which was us. And here we are now. The question is, are we at the beginning of a change, or are we at the end of our own existence here on planet Earth? Have we forfeited our right to be here with the nuclear technology that we've developed and misused, with the aerosol technology that we've developed and misused, and much, much more? Welcome back. It is September 28th, 2013. Joining us, our favorite truth freak right here on Truth Frequency. Brooks Agnew, of course. He is a scientist, teacher, world explorer, and much more. And he shed a lot of reason. He was definitely the voice of reason during the whole Comet Elenin situation. And I'm sure that he's going to have a lot to add about Comet Ison, especially since we've had fireballs in the sky for the past couple of days. So these fireballs are undeniable. Maybe we can get to the bottom of them. I don't know. It just happened yesterday at 1 o'clock in the morning, so I don't know if Brooks has had a chance to look into it. But as a scientist and much more, I'm pretty sure that he has something to say about it. Brooks, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you, definitely. Tell us about X-Squared Radio first and foremost.
Well, X-Squared Radio is a Sunday night radio program that I host between 8 and 11 Eastern, 5 to 8 Pacific. And we explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We try to do it in a positive manner. Lately, I guess about the last year, we've been covering some of the amazing thing that's happening in political science from a scientific point of view, not necessarily a political point of view. And we're just trying to create some awareness and some understanding, trying to remove people's fear, and also trying to make them aware of how to position themselves for this strange high strangeness that we're experiencing right now.
There is definitely a lot of high strangeness. I want to get into the Navy Yard shooting with you as well, because I've heard rumors that they were actually trying to arrest Obama, and that was the reason why the Navy Yard shooting happened. Have you heard anything about the along those lines?
Yeah, there was some rumors out there that there were some military personnel, not high level but medium level, who were trying to arrest Obama for, or at least bring impeachment proceedings against him for high crimes and misdemeanors, and a lot of people are wondering about basically all the shootings that we've had in the last couple of years, because they're so strange. The supposed Batman shooting that we had out in Colorado, we had a very strange school shooting in Sandy Hook, and now we have in the Navy Yard, and there have been a few others. And the unique common thread between all of these is, A, there's always been some kind of prescription drugs involved in it. Mm-hmm. B, there's been some kind of mind control, either experimentation or treatment that's been going on. And almost all of the shooters who have lived through it have said something about voices that they've heard, people that were following them, some kind of amnesia that goes on relative to why they did the shooting, why they were conducting what they were doing. And, of course, the Naval Yard shooter did not survive. But prior to that, he had a lot of public statements that he was making to people, that he was hearing voices, that he, in one night, changed three hotels because he swore that the microwave was talking to him.
I remember hearing that.
So, you know, why would a guy that, you know, has this kind of activity going on in his life, this kind of reports that he's making, even have access to a firearm? And even more strangely, why would those, and I've been to the Naval Yard several times, It's basically an old complex of warehouses, and each of the warehouses, they have different aspects of the Navy and contractors that work. I've gone and made presentations there myself. It is not a high-security kind of facility. It's more of a commercial military facility where contractors come and interface with the Navy, various aspects of it. The cafeteria is mostly glass. It kind of faces the river, and it looks old, like 1950s, 60s, but it's all refurbished, so it's kind of neat. Lots of old bells and brass compasses and stuff like that on display. It's kind of neat. But this guy, you know, being allowed to do what he's doing, and the local law enforcement not being allowed to do what they do, their radios were blacked out, their weapons were not allowed. They were not allowed to mobilize a SWAT team. Military police had guns, but no bullets. So it was like this guy was allowed to take his movements. And meanwhile, all of these headlines are out there that the military, namely the Navy, was getting ready to file charges against Obama for treason.
Right.
Right.
Supposedly, the treason was because they were planning to detonate a nuke in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, and they were engaging in a false flag attack. I can't substantiate any of this information, but have you heard anything along those lines, and have you come across anything that might lead you to that conclusion?
Yeah, there was actually a police commander who told his own policemen, the ones under his command, they needed to go to the bank and get all their cash out, and they needed to have a fair amount of food at the house because someone was going to set a nuke off, and he couldn't give him any more information on that. Now, why in the world would a police commander give that information to his policeman in his precinct? And how in the world could that kind of weapon make its way into an inner city area without being detected? It can't. It's impossible.
Know. But FEMA did tell us when we kind of infiltrated in a sense and got somebody to speak with us about FEMA's activities over the past several months. And he did say, you know, what if some crazy guy gets a hold of a suitcase bomb? And we were thinking, how would he get a hold of a suitcase bomb? And I guess that would make sense. If our government was colluding with them, then yeah, aren't there some nuclear weapons that are missing?
There are about 500 what are called suitcase nukes that are missing. Now they're not really suitcase nukes. They're the size of a trunk, but two guys can carry them pretty easily. There was actually a real crisis when the Soviet Union fell apart. There were a lot of caches, storehouses scattered all over the place with nuclear weapons in them. Some were large, some were missiles, and some were these small suitcase nukes. There were several hundred of them. Well, the reports are somewhere between 50 and 80 of these weapons came up missing. And the officers that were in charge of those facilities mysteriously ended up with several gold bars in their possession. So the rumor has it that some of the wealthier rogue nations came in to where Russian officers were starving to death and freezing to death, and offered them something they couldn't refuse. The Soviet Union's gone. You're broke. You're never going to pull your head out of this cold freeze out politically and economically. Here's a couple of $1 million in gold bars. Just let us go into your facility for a couple of hours, and you can just say that you lost count. And that's exactly what happened. Now, where did these nukes go? No one knows.
Oh, they're in Israel, I'm sure.
I'm
just kidding. I say that because Israel has been so closed mouth about their nuclear programs.
They don't want anybody
looking into it. As a matter of fact, Gaddafi said that the reason they killed Kennedy was because he wanted to look into Israel's nuclear program. But now Iran's flipping it around and saying, well, you come and inspect our nukes, but you have to inspect Israel's too. And Israel isn't too happy about that.
No,
but that's what they always do. You know, they basically say, we'll show you ours if you show you yours. Show us yours. And that's typical Hezbollah, Hamas kind of tactics. I'm not really too worried about it, except that the Israelis are the second biggest exporter of weapons in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They make a tremendous amount of money off war. A lot of people don't know this, but Israel is the number one builder of drones.
Right.
And half of those drones are built right here in Mississippi.
I'm sorry, that's funny.
It doesn't surprise me, but America has been under Israeli control mm-hmm. since 1949?
Doesn't surprise me one
yeah.
bit.
Well, you say Israeli control, that's not really accurate.
Zionist control.
Yeah, I mean, basically what happened when World War II happened, there was about 16 years of economic forces from 1929 to 1945 that really moved heavily against the holdings of Jews in Europe. It was an easy blame game. The Depression had happened in 1929, which everyone knows now was a completely engineered economic event. The reparations that were saddled against Germany in the Treaty of Versailles were absolutely untenable, and everyone knew it. And it created an opportunity for the major banks to try to bail Germany out with debt, and that's exactly what they did. But Germany wasn't too happy about making the payments, and so what they did is they did what any organized working force does. They slowed down. Their mines slowed down. Go ahead and take your break.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Much more with Brooks Agnew, X Squared Radio. Don't go anywhere. And we are back right here on the Truth Frequency. We've got Brooks Agnew on the line with us, and we're discussing the geopolitical situation, but I want to switch the topic here for a moment. I want to talk about ISON, and some strange things have been happening, of course. Fireballs in the sky. We've noticed a lot of electromagnetic interference, cell phone interruption. The board operator over at GCN just told me that for the past couple of days, he's been getting a lot of electric shocks coming from the electronics there. Now, I know in the wintertime here, it gets so crazy that the walls will actually start to shock us. Drywall will start to shock, and I believe that's from the wires that are running on the inside, but in the wintertime, deep winter, it's expected. But something strange has been happening over the course of the last few days, and I was wondering if you can shed some light on that, Brooks.
Well, certainly it's unusual because we have regular encounters. The Earth regularly encounters on an orbital path each year the leftovers of various cometary tails. I mean, we get the Perseids, we get leftovers from Halley's Comet, we get all kinds of things that are regular, and we understand them, we expect them, but we're kind of in between those right now. So to see fireballs in the sky, especially on the kind of frequency that we're seeing them, these aren't, mind you, shooting stars. Those are fairly common every night. Sometimes they're more frequent than others, but fireballs have a tendency to go much slower because they get slowed down in the atmosphere. They leave a tail behind them. They often split in two or three, make a blue-green kind of trail behind them. And I've seen them, driving down to Mississippi sometimes along Highway 90. They look like they land in the trees. They come so low. I mean, you literally brace against the steering wheel because you think it's going to hit. But the last year or so, we have seen what we call errant fireballs. These are ones that are not expected. They're just showing up. And now they also don't show up on what's called near Earth object radar because these are pretty small. Could be the size of a baseball or the size of a grapefruit. They're not going to show up on radar, but when they hit the atmosphere, they make a tremendous show. That comes from.
These have lit up the sky. I don't know if you saw the pictures from last night, but the entire sky lit up.
It doesn't take much. I mean, the size of a baseball can make it where you can read a newspaper, especially if it slows down in the atmosphere. A grapefruit, if it's dense enough, if it's a hard metal ball, it can actually reach the surface if it's on the right angle. Most of them are very tangential. That is to say, they come in and skip off the upper atmosphere and go on out into space. But they put off a lot of light when that happens.
I've said this many times before, so the listeners have heard this, but I want to get your take on this. We have been experiencing these gusts of wind that are followed by electromagnetic fields that are set off car alarms and cause other electronic disturbances. There's no quakes with them. There's nothing like that. It's just like these clouds of electronic energy. Have you heard of this phenomenon? And if so, any thoughts on it?
Yeah, straight line wind. It's a phenomenon. You know, usually when we have cold and hot air come together, they swirl around each other. They create circular patterns in the northern hemisphere. Usually that's counterclockwise. In the southern hemisphere, it's clockwise. And it can draw cold air in and warm air up, and that's where most of your storm systems come from. But straight line winds, typically you see them out west, especially in places like New Mexico or Phoenix. They're really apocalyptic looking because they can pick up a lot of dust, and they just come in and look like something off of, you know, the Mummy movie. But straight line winds across relatively green territory don't pick up a lot of dust. They just come in about 70 or 80 miles an hour. It's a straight line. It crosses an area. It lowers the pressure significantly in the area because of the speed of the wind. It can rip up a lot of stuff very quickly. It only lasts maybe 4 or 5 minutes. But in moving, especially when it's dry, they create a tremendous amount of static charge. That's what makes these electronics really go haywire.
Ah. The voice of reason, ladies and gentlemen, Brooks Agnew. We'll talk about ISON on the other side, because I know there's a lot of hype going on right now. And I'm starting to experience some of the unsettling feelings that come along with some of the hype when we see fireballs, when we see electromagnetic interferences at the exact same time that they're saying that ISON is getting near. We'll find out more on the other side with Brooks Agnew. We'll be right back. There have been some very strange pictures circulating around from ISON, and we already know that, or of ISON, I should say, we already know that NASA manipulates the photos, and they manipulated the Mars surface. They edit out buildings on Mars and other structures on the moon. So people have also speculated that they're doing the same with shots of ISON. And there's a couple of particular pictures that I'm looking at where they claim that the pictures were overexposed, and when you remove the overexposure from them, what you get is it looks like a triangle. It looks like a winged planet. It's a ball in the middle, and it has two distinct tails coming out of it, but the tails are, if you're looking at it straight on, it's at about the 8 o'clock and the 4 o'clock position. So it's very strange, but Brooks, I was wondering if you can give us your take on this.
Yeah. You know, when Elenin came around, we first started getting the pictures of Elenin, and people said the same thing. I mean, it looked a little bit like the vessel in Star Trek, you know, that it had some structure to it. It had some spires that kind of stuck out in the front. And there were a lot of rumors that went out around about Elenin, and I came on your program before it ever really became an issue, and I said, I think Elenin's going to evaporate like a bunch of bad breath, and it's not going to get very close to Earth anyway. And it didn't. It got out to about, I don't know, 180, 190 million miles from Earth, which is a long way, very inconsequential. And sure enough, Elenin evaporated, and all of the scare websites, you know, slowly aged and went away. ISON is a little bit different, and it's different in three ways. Number one is it's never been here before. It's brand new out of the Oort cloud system, and that means that it has never had a close pass to a star like our sun before, which means everything that's on the surface of this comet is what we call virgin or pristine ice. And that means there may be a lot of volatile compounds on comets. Comet number two, comets are unpredictable because they're not asteroids. The fact that they're frozen balls of ice of various densities is one thing, but when they get close to the sun, that ice begins to boil off. And whether it's carbon dioxide or methane or water, it comes off with sort of like a retro rocket kind of action on the body of that comet. So the comet's path changes because it works like a jet, in a space jet kind of, and it blasts the comet to different pathways. That's why it becomes unpredictable. Now, ISON's different in a third way because it's going to come very, very close to the sun, within about 700,000 miles. That is so intense. If the comet survives and it goes whipping around this highly elliptical orbit around the sun, it's going to come around the other side of the sun very fast, if it survives. If it goes behind the sun where we can't see it and it evaporates, then we don't have anything to worry about. It's 2, maybe 3 kilometers across, which is a fairly good-sized comet, but coming that close to the sun is highly unique. If it blows up into one big cloud, it can be just as hazardous to the Earth as if it comes whipping around the sun intact. And here's why. Because the Earth is also revolving around the sun, and it is going to pass through the pathway that ISON leaves. Now, the head will be long gone. It won't come very close to Earth at all, maybe 50 million miles. But the tail, we will pass almost directly through it. Brand new stuff. It could be chunks. It could be trash. ISON could be hauling stuff with it. And we could have quite a time with the leftovers of Comet ISON.
Is this set to happen in December?
It is actually the first visible parts of it for the naked eye should be November. And by the way, I'm not so worried about what NASA is deleting, because there are literally thousands of high-powered telescopes looking at this comet. And these telescopes are very, very capable. They're reflecting telescopes. They're hooked up to digital cameras that can take oversampling, which means you can actually learn to track the comet. And you can get very high-resolution photographs of it. We should start seeing some of those come in now. Not from NASA, but from private parties. You can't stop it. There are thousands and thousands of people looking at this comet. It could be so bright we can see it in the daytime with the naked eye. That would be remarkable. A lot of people are talking that down, saying that ISON will evaporate much sooner than we can see it with the naked eye. But we don't really know for sure. It depends on what is actually frozen in the head of that comet.
Do we know for sure that it's only a couple of kilometers? Because
right.
They're saying that it's going to be 15 times brighter than the moon. And that's pretty darn bright, if you ask me.
It will be, but it's still not very massive. What will be bright is the sun reflecting off the tail of the comet and what's called the corona of the comet. As this begins to boil off, it will catch the sun's rays and reflect it out into space. That you will see. And it could be pretty large, maybe 50 times or 100 times the size of the comet. But the actual mass of the comet is pretty well known, based on its trajectory, it's how it's affected by the other planets as it's passed through the solar system. We've got it nailed down to plus or minus a school bus.
What about the Treblinka meteor that hit in Russia within the past couple of years? Wouldn't that one be detectable at least by our satellites? If we can detect something like ISON, which isn't supposed to do much of anything to us, you know, why couldn't we see that one?
Well, that's a good question, and here's how to answer it. It was a very high latitude asteroid. We only really have one satellite that can detect it. It's called the Space Shield. And right now, the Space Shield is shut off. We don't really know why. They're saying it's sequestration.
Right.
There's a bunch of crap about,
yeah,
you know, why they're not running it.
Balloon.
But it is a mid-latitude satellite, so it can't really see above, say, the 20th or the 15th parallel. And that's why that Russian one snuck in without being seen. The Space Shield was on at the time that asteroid came in. It wasn't very large. It was probably about the size of a grapefruit. What was unique about it is the very low attack angle it took to come in. And it came in during the daytime, and it created a sonic boom, which is very unique for an asteroid.
What about the deep impact study? Is that what you were talking about that got sequestered?
Yes, exactly. And sequestration, it's kind of interesting. You know, I do quite a bit of business with the government, and sequestration has hit some areas harder than others. It was supposed to be even across the board, but it seems like the part of the budget office that's controlling who gets hit with this is it's almost like they're engineering it in such a way that it exposes the American people to much more danger than what we're supposed to see.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And it is kind of suspicious that the deep impact study is canceled now, right before we have ISON coming. We have all these other asteroid threats and meteor threats that we are becoming aware of. And all of a sudden, oh, well, that goodbye to that.
Yeah, and it's absolute nonsense, Sherry, because the problem is that this sequestration actually only cuts back to about where we were a couple of years ago. We were spending a ton of money 2 years ago. All this sequestration really does is cut back the rate of increase. So we're spending plenty of money to take care of these low-budget programs. They're cutting back these low-budget programs on purpose, on purpose. And the other program that stands to be cut, and this is going to be interesting to your listeners, because everyone knows that right now the current administration controls the general populace of the country because over half of it depends on some kind of benefit or check from the federal government.
Welfare, yeah.
But, you know, manipulating veterans' benefits or even Social Security check doesn't have near the effect of cutting those food stamp cards off for a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
You cut those food stamp cards off for a couple of weeks and you blame the Republicans?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
It doesn't matter what they say. You won't get a Republican within 1,000 feet of Congress.
And we'll see food rights as well and all kinds of other problems that you wouldn't see with those other programs. You try telling a lady, oh, sorry, you can't feed your kid for a couple weeks.
Oh, just look at what happened when Popeyes ran out of chicken during his special. I don't know if you remember
ridiculous.
That, but it was ridiculous. People were yelling at the intercom for Popeyes.
Yeah.
And then you see what happens at Black Friday. Now, let's take that scenario, multiply it by 1,000,000, and there you go. That's exactly what's going to happen.
Well, you know, in the last segment, we were talking about the crash of 1929 and how engineered that was. That's the setup to that was we went through two post-war major recessions. The middle class had exploded to a bigger portion of our economy than has ever been seen before. Everybody was making money. The stock market was making money hand over fist. If you decided to have a war in a time like that and you were relying upon enlistments, I'm sorry to say you would not be able to fill your ranks. But if you've evaporated the middle class by breaking it economically, breaking their will and forcing them to stand in line for soup or bread or one day's work, you could probably get them to enlist to go fight a war. It doesn't take a great historian or even a rocket scientist to figure out what's going on. We are being economically set up.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely see that happening. I do want to ask you this, though, Brooke. So what the hell are they preparing for? Are they preparing for an economic shutdown? Are they preparing for the destruction of the power grid? Or are they preparing for something even bigger than that? Because they are definitely preparing. FEMA's ordering food, sending it to FEMA Region 3. They've been buying bullets and weapons and, I mean, you name it. We've got all these underground bunkers all over the place. I guess we'll get into that on the other side. And don't forget, we have another jam-packed hour for you at truthfrequencyradio.com after the program finishes with Brooke Sagnew. So don't go anywhere. All right, final segment here on the Genesis Communications Network, but of course we do the other hour at truthfrequencyradio.com. So in this final segment, Brooks, can you please tell the audience again about X Squared Radio and about a few of the books that you've authored and where they can pick those up?
Sure. X Squared Radio is a Sunday night radio program between 8 and 11 at x2-radio.com on the BBS radio network. We've been on the air for about 8 years. Listening audience varies. Sometimes it's more live than archive, but there's about 2,500 hours of archives up there for you to enjoy all kinds of specialists in all kinds of fields. And, of course, we cover the news of the day every week. The books, the latest one is called Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. It is a book about a call to action for a state-led constitutional convention to make several amendments to the Constitution to disarm and disable the agency government that now controls our country. It was evidently a very, very good book because Mr. Mark Levin took it point for point and wrote his own book called The Liberty Amendments and has almost assumed the number one position we had on Amazon.com. The book prior to that is called Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel.
Let me add something real quick. They say imitation is the biggest form of flattery.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. I think a lot of Mark Levin, and I think he's more qualified to talk about constitutional amendments than I am. I just found it coincidental that he picked the same three to repeal and the same six to pass.
Well, I do have to say this, Brooks. You have been spot on pretty much 100%, if not 100%, on everything you've said on this broadcast in the last 3 years that we've been speaking to you.
That's why we have you on so often.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when we have all this hype like ISON and things like that, I mean when I say that you are the voice of reason, I really mean that because you have been spot on about everything.
Well, I really appreciate that. I hope that I'm wrong about ISON, but I know that it's going to be a junkyard when we pass through that tail, and it really depends on what side of the planet is facing it. It could be a fun time. History has had a very dark view of comets, and they didn't get that because it was pretty lights in the sky.
Right. Right. We are at a point now where we can track these incoming objects and they're no longer just, oh my God, God is angry at us. Now there's scientific reason behind all of this. But then again, is that playing into a lot of the fear and hype, the scientific reasoning behind it? And people are taking that scientific reasoning and expanding upon it and expanding upon it and expanding upon it. And here we are facing Armageddon every 2 weeks.
Well, there are people out there that have to, you know, make a living, and so they hype things. But it could still be God pissed off at us.
I don't know. I think God is more loving than that.
Yeah.
Well, could be. I wish you'd look the other way for a while. I had a very, very important shipment that was supposed to be in this week that got stuck in the hurricane in China. So.
Oh, no.
That's all right.
There have been crazy weather changes. I'd like to talk to you about that in the third hour, I should say. But please tell us more about some of the work that you have.
Yeah, and the first four books were called The Ark of Millions of Years, which is a four-book series on the advent of 2012. Now, I know we're in 2013, but there have been countless television specials about, you know, the Babylonian scrolls, the Mayans, the Egyptians. If you really ever want to make sense out of all that and really get the straight scoop, you need to read the Ark of Millions of Years series. It's the best 2,000 pages ever written on the 2012 saga. And we're not through it yet. In fact, the things that we wrote in the fourth volume, which were kind of foundation work for Remembering the Future, they are occurring just the way that we outlined it in the final volume.
Can you give us a little sneak peek of that?
Well, most of them are Earth changes. We made about 44 different Earth change predictions. And they're all coming to pass, not the least of which is the new island off the coast of Pakistan.
Ah.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in. We'll see you every Saturday and Sunday right here on the Genesis Communications Network. And, of course, over at truthfrequencyradio.com. So we'll be right back.
See you tomorrow, guys.
It is hour number 3 this September 28th, 2013. We're speaking with Dr. Brooks Agnew, dear friend of ours, regular guest on the broadcast. And we can get into so much in this hour. Uninterrupted is what I love the most. And I think we can talk about Hollow Earth and ISON and maybe even the new island that's formed in Pakistan as well. So I guess, Brooks, let's start with the let's pick up where we left off with the ISON situation. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Well, you know, comets, as I said, are so unpredictable because when they start off-gassing, it's like they're covered with retro rockets, so they can steer themselves, turning left, turning right, up, down, accelerate, stop. They can do all kinds of weird stuff depending on how the ice is laid out. The fact that Ison is a brand new star grazer, that is to say, it has never been boiled off before, which is what we call pristine ice. It could be frozen carbon dioxide, it could be frozen methane, it could also be frozen water, and we're not really sure what comets are, whether they're an exploded ocean from an ancient planet. We just don't know. It's a big cloud that's extra solar system. It's out there with a maelstrom of ice bodies. So Ison is a new player. It is going to pass very, very close to the sun, within 700,000 miles to the sun. And no, it doesn't matter if it goes at night. Okay, it's still going to boil off a lot of stuff. And that means that the tail is going to be literally millions of miles long. And it's going to pass very close to Mars. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. We'll be watching it from space and also from the surface, because little opportunities cameras are turned up, and they're going to be watching that comet when it passes overhead. So we're going to get a from the surface of Mars look as it goes by. There's lots of interesting information we're going to get about Ison. After it goes behind the sun, it is going to be accelerated because its orbit is elliptical. It comes very close to the sun and then it whips back out into space.
Like a slingshot effect.
Like a slingshot, right. Like a highlight player grabbing a ball and giving it a sling against the wall. If it survives that pass behind the sun, we're going to know about it in a few weeks. And it will pass directly across Earth's path in orbit, which, and the tail will too, which means all the garbage that's being towed by it through space is going to be right in our path. So it really depends on which side of the Earth is facing the comet tail when we go through. That's kind of a crapshoot. We really don't know right now because we don't have an exact minute when that's going to happen. And Earth rotates so fast on its axis once every 24 hours, it's very difficult to make that prediction where exactly we're going to hit that tail. Now, I have recalled the story of the Great Chicago Fire on your program before. Mm-hmm. And I made... maybe the revelation on your program that fire might have been a cometary tail that we passed through, a tremendous amount, literally millions of cubic yards of methane that we passed through. It's highly electrical charged because it's not grounded to Earth, and that means that when it reaches our atmosphere, at least to a density that is meaningful, it will begin to discharge electricity. And when that happens, the combination of methane and oxygen makes a really, really hot fire. That fire descended upon not only Chicago, but five states at the same time and burned whole forests and buildings to the ground in 5 minutes flat.
So what you're saying is, depending on what this comet is made of, what this meteor is made of, if it's made of methane, then it could very well cause kind of an event similar to that, except worse, because we are more connected to our electronic devices than ever before in human history. And we have so many, of these electrical, generators that are on the verge of being messed up anyway, that are broken down and very old. They could all catch on fire.
Well, I don't know about the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse. I do know that it's going to bring a lot of electricity into the upper atmosphere. Whether that makes its way to the power grid remains to be seen. That actually presents another problem. You know, the NERC, which is the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, it is a private corporation. It is almost completely funded by taxpayer funds. Its job is to tie together all the power systems in Canada and the United States into one grid. We call it the grid. It's a difficult job because not only do you have to match the frequency, 60.00 hertz, but you have to match the phase of each of those three phases. If they're out, even by a half a degree, it creates a tremendous amount of feedback, heat, and power loss. So the NERC is serving a role in that they can take extra power that's made, say, in Niagara, and they could reroute it to Seattle through the grid. It's a brilliant idea. But in doing this, it has created a triple threat vulnerability. One, which in their own study they call natural or cyber attacks, which means, you know, someone's going to attack the grid or someone's going to cyber attack the grid. The second is called pandemic, which is where you have, you know, a widespread flu that's somewhat deadly or incapacitating, and people that know how to do stuff on the grid are incapacitated. How do you take control of the sections of the grid that are affected by a pandemic? And the third is from natural disasters like EMPs or solar flares. And that vulnerability would not exist if we hadn't tied the grid together. So we have made a proposal through the Breakthrough Energy Movement to section off part of the money, about $200 billion that the NERC is going to raise over the next 3 or 4 years to accomplish this, siphon off about $2 billion of that to build what is called low-voltage local energy supplies. We call it the Breakthrough Energy Movement Fund, the BEFF. And this is designed to develop 110-volt and 220-volt power supplies on the local level from advanced technologies. And a lot of people say, oh, the power companies will never let you do that. That's nonsense. That's not going to cost them a single dime. They just charge more for the electricity. You won't be selling this energy back to the grid. This is backup energy.
Right.
This is something that will keep hospitals and police departments and schools and traffic systems running if the grid goes down. However, they have made no effort whatsoever to open their ears to this proposal. We have made it on a government level. We've made it on a state level. We've made it on an international level. We proposed it in Holland last November. We're going to propose it again in October in Boulder, Colorado. And they are turning a deaf ear to us. They haven't allowed us to sequester a single dollar toward these advanced technologies that could save us from a blackout like that.
Why not? Because they don't want us to have electricity if something were to happen. They want to bring in the UN peacekeeping troops and just completely take over the country and turn it into a dark age?
Well, those are two possibilities. I can't imagine any world leader, not a governor, not a president, not even a mayor, that would want their city to go back to rubbing two sticks together to make fire. Everybody wants to survive this. Why they're not listening to us is beyond me. Maybe they don't think we're legitimate. Maybe they don't think that the infrastructure that we have set up with nine different countries supporting it with their top engineers and politicians willing to vet some of this technology, get these things from the prototype stage into the production stage. I think they just don't want us to have the power. They don't want us to have the money. They don't want us to have the influence. I really haven't been able to figure it out. To me, it flabbergasts me because of, you know, the patents that we have, the accomplishments that we've made, how many times we have pulled General Motors and Ford and Toyota and Nissan's butt out of the fire with our ability to solve engineering problems. We have a track record that is decades long. We should be able to, and I've made this case, you know, before, 18 congressmen, two senators, a governor, the leader of, at that time was the minority leader of Congress, and, two secretaries, one of, transportation and one of energy. And it fell completely on deaf ears. They had no clue what we were talking about.
Let me jump in with a few thoughts. Those that control the past control the present. And therefore, we've pretty much digitized all of our history, all of our books, all of everything is digital. Maybe they're welcoming an event that takes the entire power grid down and wipes out the surface so they can go down to their bunkers with their slaves or their slave races, or maybe they'll even genetically engineer slave races, and then they emerge and they completely change the entire history of mankind, just like they have many times before. I mean, we just found a wheel, not a wheel, it was a gear, actually, of a machine that's 300 million years old, yet mainstream historians want to tell us that we're only 6,000 years old, 10,000 years old, maybe even 100,000 years old, but we're talking about 300 million year old machines that we're finding. So apparently our history is way bigger than we've ever expected it to be, or we've been led on to believe. And so on that note, maybe it's because the plantation, the people that are running the plantations are starting to wake up. And so their only course of action is to burn the whole plantation down and start over.
Yeah, well, it could be. But I will say this, though, Chris. Our audiences are not going to be taken in by this. But that being said, we are already a slave race. We are already completely dependent upon handouts by the government. And I think for the last maybe 6 or maybe even 7 years, we've seen the last free election in the United States of America. Because the general public is stupid. They don't have any idea what history is. And I think 90% of the people could not even name a book that they have read, a single author, nor could they explain how the houses of government work. I think they're completely ignorant. So controlling history is kind of a joke when it comes to the general public.
Right. My son spends more time on the iPad at school than he does reading books. And that scares me because that means that they're not teaching them anything about history. They're not making them read any of the classics. And they're not teaching them even how to write cursive anymore. It's all done.
Let me ask you this, Brooks. How many copies of Remembering the Future are out there? Physical copies.
Oh, about 10,000.
Okay, see, 10,000 versus how many people have read it? Probably in the hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions. We know, us personally, we purchased the digital copy of it. But see what happens? All that disappears.
Well, it could be. I hope not. I hope that the storytellers around the campfire don't have to pick up the pieces of this nation and put it back together. We had a proud heritage. I was going to say a patriotic heritage, but I actually personally believe that patriotism is dangerous. I think it's led us to jump to conclusions, to shout slogans, and fire up the jets and go pound the crap out of people when it wasn't necessary.
Right.
I've seen, I've read enough history. I look at the way, for instance, Abraham Lincoln handled the secession of 13 states from the Union. Everyone who studies that knows he did it wrong. Mm-hmm. Everyone sees a complete lack of leadership, something that was engineered by the banks. It was designed to destroy a dual economy in this country and bring everyone subservient unto a single economy. I look at the way Bush stood on the rubble at 9/11 and said, basically, we're going to go pound the crap out of the people that are responsible for this. That was a complete lack of leadership. What he should have said is, this is a tragedy, this is terrible, and guess what? Everybody responsible for this is dead. So we're going to lick our wounds, and we're going to rebuild these buildings, and I dare you to try it again. He didn't do that. Instead, he plunged us into a 20-year war we will never pull out of.
Not completely, no. And it invested so much of our military and our dollars into the Middle East and into that whole area that we can't even take care of ourselves now.
Yeah, but everyone knows why that was. It was to ensure the petrodollar. And did it work? No, it didn't work. You got Russia and China that are trading in oil right now without using petrodollars.
Mm-hmm.
And what's our solution? Oh, let's print $85 billion a month and stick it in the bond market.
Yep. It's ridiculous.
Nobody reads history. If they did, they would see precisely what Hitler did in World War II, which was completely engineered by Roosevelt and his Soviet agents and the banks. It's so easy to read.
History is repeating itself for sure. But we don't know our history, and that's the problem, is that we don't bother to know. So we repeat the mistakes inevitably.
But the history was crafted by the winners.
Right.
You know, they're a fantastic author. Her name is Diana West, and she wrote a book called American Betrayal. And she went through all the hard evidence of what went on during Lend-Lease and World War II and why, you know, Roosevelt was elected four times and what was going on there. And she documented a de facto invasion by the Soviets in 1929. By the time Roosevelt came to power, the Soviets had complete control of D.C. They needed World War II in order to seize Eastern Europe. That was the whole reason behind it. And the one lead agent behind the whole thing was a man named Harry Hopkins, who was Roosevelt's right-hand man. Roosevelt was, by the time his first term was over, he was pretty much suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia. Harry Hopkins put him on for another 11 years as a figurehead, a media event. He took over everything, including the movement and manipulation and supply of our troops in the Pacific Theater and the European Theater. And when I finished my 3-hour interview with her, I asked her point blank, do you think Valerie Jarrett is Obama's Harry Hopkins? And she said, yes. Of course we're repeating history, but it's not a history anybody read about. It's the real history.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
And what do you think about the latest events in Pakistan? It's like they're following the Revelation playbook. First, we have a terror attack that kills 86 people in front of a Pakistani church. It's a Christian church. And then a few days later, a huge earthquake hits that creates a new island out of the sea, which, you know, goes along with the book of Revelation and I think the book of John as well. And so what is going on? Are they following a playbook with HAARP, or is this actually a natural event that's taking place?
Well, as I said, you know, before, you can't count God out of the picture, but what's happening in Pakistan is not unique to Pakistan, but it certainly seems to have some cause and effect. You know, in 1990, the early 1990s, sinkholes started opening up in the Dead Sea. There were about 40 of them. Today, there are about 3,000 of them, and they mm-hmm. can't keep up with it. The Dead Sea is dying. It's falling into the earth. By the way, this goes along with the third volume of the Ark of Millions of Years. We said in the first volume that there would be a massive earthquake and that the Jafar Triangle would rip open and the Dead Sea would begin filling in the gap. We published the book 1 month after we published the book. The Jafar Triangle had an earthquake while there was an archaeological team there, and it ripped open about 300 yards of it, and it filled in with the Dead Sea. So this is exactly what is happening in Pakistan. That island that popped up out of the sea off the coast is not an island. It's a bubble. It's putting off volcanic gas, and I cannot believe people took a field trip out there. Hey, let's go take some pictures from the new island.
Yeah, it's really dumb.
That's right. That thing is the top of a volcanic bubble, and if it blows, the tsunami will wipe the coast of Pakistan off the map.
Let me go back to ISON for a second, because I did want to ask you this earlier. Lovejoy, I believe, was the comet that went into the sun and survived. If these suns are basically big snowballs, how is it? I mean, if these comets are basically big snowballs, how is it that they can survive going into the sun? Is it possible that they're made of something else?
Well, it is possible, and there are a couple theories on that. If these are very dense comets, sometimes when they boil off the outer skin of the comet, the effusion actually refreezes the surface. It's sort of like stepping out of the pool at midnight in Phoenix when it's 100 degrees, but the humidity is 5%. You will go into hyperthermia. It's 100 degrees, and you're shivering. It's because the water is evaporating so fast off your skin that it pulls the heat right out of your skin and it drops your body temperature. Same thing with a comet. But these comets have to be very dense. It has to be one solid head. That's not usual. Usually it's a bunch of ice chunks that are held together by a loose handshake. Not much gravity in a comet. So once it gets close to the sun, it undergoes what's called, it crosses what's called the Roche or Roche limit. This is where the gravity of the larger body, usually it's one diameter of that body out into space, overcomes the gravity of the smaller body, and the tiny bit of gravity that's been holding that smaller body together gives way, and the body begins to come apart. Same thing as Shoemaker did when it crashed into Jupiter. It wasn't friction that tore it apart, it was the Roche limit. But if it's very incorporated, that is to say the head is one solid chunk of ice, it's not gravity that holds it together, it's hydrogen bonding, which sticks very well, and the head didn't come apart. It went around the sun very close to the surface and survived.
Fair enough. That's probably the best explanation for that I've ever heard, so thank you.
What about the inner Earth theories when it comes to what happened in Pakistan? Because I know I keep going back to this, but it does seem to me like there's things happening to the surface of the planet that might be indicative of something going on inside.
Well, inside is relative. Remember, the planet's about 7,400 miles in diameter. So what occurs at the surface is not really indicative of what's going on inside the planet. However, if the theories are correct, we have a mantle that's some 12 to 1,500 miles thick. That's really the planet that we're concerned with, that undulating thick bubble around the core of our planet, which rotates substantially slower than the core, is subject to all kinds of forces, gravitational waves, the stretching and shrinking of the moon going around our planet, other, shall we call them, gravity or magnetic threads or ropes that go through space. We don't know a lot about them, but we do know that they affect the auroras around the planet, independent of the sun, independent of the solar wind. And that kind of stuff happening, say, in the top 200 miles of the planet is what we're really mostly concerned with. It's where all of our earthquakes happen. It's where all of our volcanoes occur. What goes on below 200 miles doesn't really affect the surface that much.
Okay.
What about nuclear blasts, things like that? I've heard that the people in the inner Earth were very upset when we detonated the atomic bombs.
Well, I'm upset too.
I mean, right, of course, but it affected their landscape as well.
Yeah, over 2,600 nuclear blasts all over the planet have gone off. It's utter, complete insanity. Now, the interesting thing about a nuclear blast, whether it's a fission bomb or a fusion bomb, and most of the latter ones have been the latter, fusion bombs. These are where we are fusing hydrogen together and we're feeding extra neutrons into it using mostly tritium to make it a higher yield explosion. It puts off an electromagnetic pulse that goes out between 600 and 1,000 miles in all directions, including inside the planet. So if there's anything intelligent or advanced inside the planet, it's going to be very upset that we're blowing off all these bombs.
Quick bottom of the hour break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Another half-hour segment on the other side with Brooks Agnew. And I want to get into Arc of Millions of Years, because there were some interesting theories in there about two different Earths, and the Earth is actually 4.5 billion years old, and at the same time, it's 6,000 years old. So maybe we can pry Brooks a little bit to disclose a little bit of the book in that context. We'll be right back. Came across an interesting piece of information today that apparently has been circulating for a while. I just never bothered to look. But apparently there is a more accurate representation of our planet Earth than the maps that we see in schools and everywhere else. And the reason for this is because you make a country or nation look bigger on the map, then all of a sudden it just subliminally and subconsciously has more importance.
More power.
More power, exactly. But there's a map called Peter's Map, the Peter's Project map, and it actually shows a more accurate and fair representation of what our Earth actually looks like. And China is huge. It's way bigger than the United States. Africa is about as big as the North and, well, about the South America and North America put together up until about mid-United States. So it's a vast, vast, vast region, way bigger than the United States, but we want to make these third world populations feel a little bit smaller and smaller and smaller. Brooks, what are your thoughts on the Peter Project map? Have you had a chance to look at that?
No, I really haven't, and I hate to comment on stuff I haven't read very carefully. So I'm a little bit at a loss, but I can tell you, because I've been to most of those countries, that they suffer from internal stress like our country, you know, doesn't have. We have fairly stable communities that have their own economies, almost state by state. Some states have multiple economies, like California has three main economies. Texas has multiple economies. But these countries that you're talking about have been so dependent upon a central government for so long that they don't have individual stabilities. They're integral with their government. Now, the issue that this presents is sort of like having 12 kids and you're working two jobs already. As the kids get older, they eat more. And now you're spending $600 or $700 or $1,000 a week bringing food home just to feed them. If you lose your job, that family is going to implode from the inside out. That's exactly what's going to happen to China. China is not nearly as productive as we are. If you drive the countryside, say between Shanghai and Jiangsu City, which is about a 4-hour drive through the countryside, oh, you'll see a lot of farms. In fact, the whole area is all farmland, but there's nothing growing. There are no tractors. There's no irrigation systems. Everything is done by hand. That's not the kind of agricultural community that can support a nation of 2 billion people. That's why China exports people. That's its main export. They export people to every country. And right now, you mentioned Africa, they're exporting millions and millions of Chinese men to Africa. They're also exporting money. They're building schools, hospitals, water treatment plants, bridges. Do you think the African people can build that for themselves? No. The Chinese are moving their experts, their breedable males, and money into Africa. What do you think will happen to Africa in 50 years? It won't be Africa anymore.
That is true. I do remember in CFR documents from the 40s, Jan Ervin was looking into this, and he brought to the table some quotes that said, "We must never let the African Union unite. Never. At all costs." That was the biggest enemy for Africa to unite. Why do you think that is? My interpretation is that there's so many resources there that if they actually took hold of those resources, they would become a superpower themselves.
Well, not just that. They would be able to starve out the superpowers. But it's never going to happen. The ECOWAS, which is the Economic Community of West African States, was formed specifically to grab hold of those resources. Diamonds, tanzanites, rubies, oil, gold. Because warlords were trading those high-value items for arms. And so ECOWAS came in and literally seized control of all of those resources so that those resources would be turned into cash. However, every single one of those resources is a cartel. The diamond cartel, the oil cartel. The only commodity that Africa has that they could really control is food. And I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, it's beginning to make a turn. Very smart, very well-educated people, not only from North Africa but also from South Africa, are going in there and they're beginning to build modern farms with modern equipment and modern irrigation systems, and you're beginning to see a change like nothing we have ever seen before. You think it was a coincidence that last year there were three presidents, two former, actually four presidents. There were three former presidents and President Obama in South Africa at the same time.
Right.
That was not coincidental. That's because South Africa is the next economic frontier.
Let me go to a quote here. My father says that almost the whole world is asleep. Everybody you know, everybody you see, everybody you talk to. He says that only a few people are awake, and they live in a state of constant total amazement. I know you know that one.
It was a great line from Joe versus the Volcano.
Yes.
That made to Tom Hanks.
The first time I heard you on Coast to Coast, you quoted that, and that actually stuck, and I actually made a techno song and used your line in the techno song as part of it. Yeah. It was many, many years ago, back in like 2003 or 4, maybe later than that, 2005.
It was on 2005, the first time Coast to Coast.
Exactly, yes. One of the interviews I listened to over and over again, and I drove my girlfriend at the time crazy with it, was that interview about the Earth being 4.5 billion years and 6,000 years old at the same time.
That's correct.
Can we get into that briefly?
Yeah. The first book was written. My co-author, E.J. Clark, and I started the book in 2001. Because we were interested in the 2012 thing, and the deeper we dug into it, the more fascinating it became. We discovered a phenomenon that was multicultural and spread between 25,000 and 4,000 years ago, and it was called the Union of the Polarity. That's what we called it. It was the best English translation that we could make of it. And it is the theory that the Earth is actually two worlds, circumferential worlds. One is a higher vibrational matter, which the ancients called spirit matter. Then the Hopi call it the same thing. And the other is a temporal earth, which is lower vibrational matter, which is, you know, pretty much dirt. Now, when these two worlds came together, it matches the story of Genesis, how one planet was sent out from where it was divided off of another water planet, and during the flood of Noah, the two planets were merged together. It was highly cataclysmic for both worlds. There were races on both worlds, one 4.5 billion years old from the first creation, known as man and woman, and the other 6,000 years old, known as the seed of Adam, or higher Adam, which culminated with Noah and the few souls that ended up on the ship with him. When those two races combined, it created a genetic jump in not only the quality of mankind, but all of the animal life that was on the planet at that time. Because, as you know, they brought an ark with them, with life from their world. It's amazing to see the plant and animal jump in genetics that occurs about that time. And you look at the human genetics. Now we've done enough of the human genome that we've actually proven it. We didn't know anything about it in 2004, not scientifically. We just had the ancient historical records. But we have seen now that races that have not cross-married across the planet have a unique set of markers with them that the rest of the races don't have. And that's because they've kept themselves from breeding with other tribes, as it were. So now what we theorize is that around 2012, during this solar cycle 24, the two Earths are becoming dissident to one another. They're beginning to separate. And at some point in the future, perhaps at the end of this solar cycle, the higher vibrational Earth and the lower vibrational Earth will separate. All of the matter and energy that resonates with those two planets will divide as well.
You know, that's funny because Terrence McKenna said something similar, that the time waves are – yeah, he said the opposite, actually. The time waves are coming together rather than coming apart. But that would make sense if we have two different Earths moving away from each other or even coming closer together, that we're seeing all these weather changes and disruptions.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Our theory is different than his, that they're actually coming apart. They're becoming – anti-harmonious with one another. And what is actually happening to the consciousness of the human beings that are on the planet, there are 7 billion of them now, is that the very, very, shall we call them righteous or higher vibrational people are becoming unaware of the lower vibrational people. And the opposite is true. What is happening is people with dark souls become allergic to the light, so they don't go there. And it's a natural separation that's occurring.
Well, that seems to echo the dual timeline that a lot of people are talking about now, that we've moved into the dark timeline and the light timeline, and the Earths are separating. So that's very interesting. There is a lot of weirdness going on, though, and this is on a completely different topic, but I just got news that one of our hosts, Aaron Dykes, who hosts Truth Stream Media, his father just passed away at 57 years old, 57 years old. My mother passed away 2 years ago at 58 years old, and Nathan Fraser's mother just passed away two weeks ago at 58 years old as well. It seems like the lifespan has been shortened to 60 years. That's what I expect to live, 60 years. If I can get past that, I'm lucky. But, I mean, you know, you're of a different generation, Brooke, so, you know, hopefully that you have a little more time than we do, but we've been bombarded with so much more. Being of the different generation, that I think our lifespan is definitely shorter. But have you experienced a lot of loss in maybe not your immediate life, but maybe friends of yours, people that you know? Have you seen this phenomenon in your personal experience?
Yeah, I am seeing a phenomenon because I'm 58, but and I have a lot of friends, you know, that were in high school with me or even younger than I am, and they're old. They're wrinkly, they're old, they're sick, they're taking drugs, they're bent over, they can't run, they don't ride bikes, they couldn't throw a ball if their life depended on it. I'm sorry, guys, that's not me. You know, I went and worked out today, I raced go-karts 2 weeks ago. I may be 58 chronologically, but I'm not a day over 40, I swear.
Oh, I can tell. I mean, you're ready to go to the center of the earth. You know, you probably have more stamina and agility than I do, and I'm only in my early 30s. So whatever you're doing, keep it up.
Singles tennis or 18 holes of golf, we could find that out. Some people say 30.
I love tennis.
I think that's going a little bit far because God has not been friendly to the top of my head.
It took me a minute to catch that one.
It took me a second, too, yeah.
I've been lucky in that department. All my hair is still here. My grandfather died with a full set of hair. He was the one that was on my mother's side. So they say you get it from your grandfather on your mother's side. So I'm hoping that I can keep this mop top that I have.
Everyone hates you.
Yes.
I'm already 30 and I'm already starting to get gray hair. I hate it. I hate it. Everybody in my family gets gray hair early. So it's just one of those things.
One of those things.
Well, how is this, all the radiation affecting us? You know, I'm hearing conflicting stories. Of course, we have the hype all over the internet, but we have a friend of ours, Corbett, James Corbett from the Corbett Report. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He lives in Japan, and he conceived his child post-Fukushima in Japan. His wife gave birth to the child post-Fukushima, and the child is perfectly healthy. There is nothing wrong with him whatsoever, according to what he told us on the show, and I'm pretty sure that he's being completely honest with everything. But he says there's really nothing to worry about as far as the radiation goes, as long as you don't eat the fish or drink the water. But what are your thoughts?
Well, Fukushima is probably the biggest disaster of our generation, and it isn't over yet. Now, that being said, I lived in Japan for a while, too, and I visited the Fukushima plant when it was in operation. I was in Daidocho, which is in the Daiichi Prefecture. So the issue is locality. Because if you're south of there, say Osaka, or Kyoto, you're probably, you know, going to be fine because the wind generally blows in off the Pacific Ocean, which is east of the country, and believe me, it blows. It's like unbelievable. So the airborne radiation is going to be traveling west. The real risk to Fukushima comes from the 300 tons of radioactive water that is pumped into the Pacific Ocean every single day. That goes, and of course, in the disaster business, we have a slogan. It's called the solution is dilution. And that's the way that plant was built, actually. It has very large polished stainless steel tubes underneath the reactor so that if it melts through, it hits those tubes and slides out into the ocean and goes into the deep sea. That's the way they were designed. So they're doing what they were designed to do. However, the currents that are off the coast of that northern part of Japan don't go out and dilute into the ocean. They're rivers. They're oceanic rivers. And it normally carries all of the plankton and all of the krill and everything that the fish feed on in that part of the Pacific. So all the tuna, all the salmon, all the grouper, everything that feeds off of that krill that's now bathed in that radioactive water is progressively becoming more and more radioactive. The high altitude movement of air moves to the east. So Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and across the southern part of Canada, northern part of the United States is being rained upon by a chronic cesium and sometimes plutonium radiation. Both of these are alpha decays. They're extremely harmful to the human biosystems, all biosystems. We have already seen an increase in leukemia, birth defects, bone disease, and the worst is yet to come because it's cumulative. So, you know, TEPCO experts are saying that they can't control the groundwater. So we are talking about locality. If you're further south or north up to Tokyo, you're not going to be as affected as you will be in those areas that are tapping into that groundwater. So how much they try to block it is anybody's guess. The groundwater will find a way to get into the system. So if his wife had a baby post-Fukushima, I would say they were at least 100 miles away, probably more like 300 miles away from Fukushima. I would say that is going to have a greater effect on the biosystem of mankind than anything we've done in the last 25 years. And it's not over yet. That is not a disaster that's being cleaned up like it should be.
Very well said. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to take a moment for Nathan and for Aaron, and for everybody that's experienced loss out there. Brooks, I just wanted to say thank you so much for joining us today, and anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
Well, just because of the last segment, I my heart goes out to all those that have lost loved ones from mortal life, but I promise you, they are just fine. And if we did have some mistake that we had to clean up for this world to try to make things right with Mother Earth, it would be Fukushima. That's something every nation can focus on because it's going to affect the world. And we need to think about how we're creating and managing energy on this planet so that we can do it in harmony with the Earth and in harmony with every living thing on the planet.
Beautifully said. Give us the websites really quick.
All right. The one everybody needs to go to right now is it's visionev.net. Visionev.net. That's our electric vehicle company. We are going to make our launch here in a couple of months, and we can use all of the support that your audience can give us.
Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, kiss the one you love right now. You never know when the last time is going to be. We love you, and we will see you tomorrow. Same truth time, same truth channel.
See you tomorrow, guys. Love you.